today we are here with Matt Valbridge of TTJTech.net. He normally focuses on technology and resources to get people up and running to automate their home. But today, we're going to talk about a book he wrote, The Titanic, The Greatest Story Ever Told. He was fascinated with it as a kid and wrote a book in 2012. He has since updated that book with animation, audio, and even a hard copy that you can buy in stores or order online. The link to get the book in the Apple Books will be in the description, but let's sit down with him and talk to him about this book and how he came to write it. Enjoy. We are here with Matt Valbridge from TTJTech.net, but right now we are not talking about technology or Apple products or Christian stuff. We are going to be talking about the writing and recreation of the Titanic story, I guess. Matt Valbridge is the author of this book. I can't remember the exact title, so I don't butcher it up. Why don't you tell me?
it's a little bit long. It's Titanic, the most complete story ever told.
It's a great story. I mean, you know, the old saying goes, don't judge a book by its cover. And for years, I did that. I figured it was a love story. The boat crash. They fell in love. The boat crash and the story's over. So I actually watched the entire movie the other night. And it was actually a great movie, great story. I'm halfway through your book. I'll be done with it by the time we do the second part of this podcast in a couple of weeks with the seminar, Q&A, and all that good stuff. But why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of you writing this book, researching the story, and then we'll get into, I guess, for lack of a better term, some of the controversy surrounding this story.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that sounds great. Ever since I was a kid, I was extremely fascinated by the Titanic. We first heard about it. I guess I first heard about it in probably first grade. In a reading book or an article or something, there was a story about underwater exploration with submarines and you know, some of the various technology that was up and coming. And that was, as I say, first grade, so that would have been probably 1990 or 91. And it had been just a few short years after the Titanic was rediscovered, you know, where they finally found the wreck site. And so part of that story about underwater exploration talked about the Titanic. And I mean, it was literally just a paragraph or two. It wasn't anything big. But I read that part, and it just captivated me. I mean, the rest of the story, you know, I'm sure it was amazing. And knowing what I know now, it truly is incredible. But that wasn't the part that I really was interested in. I could have, you know, taken or leave or left that at that age. But I really was curious to learn everything I could about the Titanic. And so throughout my childhood, I kind of continued doing that. If I could find books on tape, or, you know, sometimes it was literally my parents reading them to me. I did have a reading machine at one point, one of those Kurzweil. They were originally Kurzweils, but it was the Reading Edge. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. But I had several of the famous books. I guess it was in eighth grade when there was a presentation given to our science class about the Titanic that I kind of made a declaration. Then I said, you know, someday I'm going to write a book about this. And that idea, that was right after we saw the movie. That was right after the movie was released also. And basically, as I got older, I didn't give too much thought to it. But, you know, every now and then I'd go back to it. I'd find a book about it, or I'd hear something in the news about it. And I guess came to about 2010, 2011, and I said, you know, 2012 will be the 100th anniversary of the sinking, and I really can't think of a better time than that to write a book about the subject of the Titanic. So that was what how that all kind of got started. And you know, praise God, he made a lot of resources available. I mean, I really kind of, you know, you said about the research, that was the biggest factor, because, you know, I really stood on the shoulders of geniuses when it came to writing the book. I mean, the story had already been told time and time again, and all the passengers at this point were, there was, I guess by the time I was writing, there were no more survivors living. A lot of historians that had met passengers and so on. So you were able to find their archives and their, you know, transcripts and interviews and things of that nature. And I also had the opportunity to talk with a cruise line employee and a couple people from the International Ice Patrol as well, to get a perspective on kind of what's happening now, you know, whether we could ever see a similar disaster to the Titanic. So that was a lot of the research. And then it was just coming up with a way to compile that fit the, you know, the way I was trying to tell the story, I guess, what I was going for with that.
Okay. So let's start with a little bit of the controversy, because some people say the story is fictional, that this was a crash that was enhanced or overdid or overemphasized, that the pieces of the ship that was found was wreckage from multiple ships. What do you say to that statement?
Yeah, it's you know, it's like just about every other major event in history. There always seems to be controversy surrounding it, and that's one of them. You know, that always seems to be popular. Just like, you know, did we really land on the moon? Of course, there's an entire group of people that insist that we didn't, and of course, we have evidence to prove that we did. But you know, that's people will do what they're going to do and say what they're going to say, I guess. You know, when Dr. Ballard, Robert Ballard, who was one of the really the pioneers of the exploration to go down and find the Titanic, he and his colleagues, along with a lot of other researchers, were able to really corroborate the evidence of all the passenger survivor accounts. Because, you know, there were a number of, in 1984, I guess, when they found the Titanic, there were a lot of passengers, a lot of survivors that were still living. And even the ones that weren't had very, very specific testimony. In some cases, it was in courtrooms, you know, in Senate hearings and transcripts from those kinds of things. And in others, it was just in interviews and documentaries. And there were even, which really is amazing, because, you know, by the Titanic disaster occurred in 1912. By this time, you started having some forms of cameras and audio recording and so forth. I mean, it was very preliminary, of course, you know, compared to what we have now. But it was enough that in probably sometime in the 1930s, the second officer of the Titanic made an audio recording that is still available today. The BBC has preserved it. And then in somewhere in the 50s, the fourth officer did the same thing. And so, you know, there's a lot of testimony from people who were there and able to combine that with, you know, going back and finding the original plans and drafts, talking with scientists, talking with these people who went down and actually saw it for themselves. And there's certainly no doubt of what actually happened and what ship it was.
Right. And then, so I guess we can, let's take a step back, because one of the statements that was made in the movie, I mean, if I'm watching this as just a person that is just an average Joe, I guess, not in the world, not in the word and in God that I am, then maybe I just dismiss this. But one of the statements that was made when the movie first started, when they were getting on the boat, and this guy said, and I can't remember who it is, you'll know as soon as I say it, and you probably know where I'm going with this. He said, and I quote, Not even God could sink this ship. Now, when he said that, all I had to do was turn it off, because I knew why the ship sank to begin with. You don't say nothing like that against God. That's straight blasphemy. I mean, I've been living in faith all my life, and that's just something you don't say.
Yeah, that was, and the thing is, that was really said. Now, the character who said it in the movie was fictional. You know, they pinned that on somebody else. For those who have seen the movie, they know who it was. It was Callan Hockley, who was the originally intended husband of Rose, you know, the mean guy. And they pinned that on him, but he didn't really exist. But there was a baggage porter, and this is recorded, you know, there's solid documentation of this that, I mean, the people now aren't living anymore, but at the time, you know, there was solid documentation that a passenger walked up to a baggage porter and said, "Is this ship really non-sinkable?" And he said, "Oh yes, ma'am, God himself could not sink this ship." It was very, very, very well known that really did happen.
Okay, now you said that Rose's husband was fictional. So was Rose a fictional character also, and this wasn't a love story? It was just a ship that sunk, and they decided to throw a love story in it? I mean, how did this all come together?
Yeah, so all of the major characters, so there's a lot of background characters that you see in that movie. You know, they show John Jacob Astor, they show Margaret Brown, they show the Countess of Roth, they show, of course, Bruce Ismay, the chairman of the White Star Lines, and a lot of the officers and the captain. Those are all real. But the sort of protagonists in the story, you know, Jack and Rose and the antagonists, which, you know, you would consider to be Cal and I guess arguably to some extent Rose's mom, though she probably was more of just a pawn in the whole thing. Those were all, you know, created after the fact for the sake of creating the love story. You know, but I think it's very likely. And as you read more of the book, and for folks who haven't read it yet, you know, when you read it, you'll see that there was probably some of their story in almost everybody, you know, because this was a situation. And as you get further in the book, of course, you'll see, you know, this was a situation where families were separated in any number of ways. And there were people, you know, there were elderly couples, there were young couples on their honeymoon, there were parents and children. And you did have, you know, I have to point out, because of course, being word-based and being focused on Christ and on his word, I always, you know, feel it necessary to point out there were some cases where you did see the entire families saved. There were a few of those, but it was definitely the minority, not the majority. In most cases, the best case scenario was for a mother and her children to survive, and they'd lose the father. And of course, the worst case scenario, you know, more people got separated. I mean, there were, some of them were just ripped apart in ridiculous ways. One of the stories that is my least favorite about the whole thing, I almost, you know, get into tears every time I tell it or think about it, was a story about the Allison family in First Class. And it was a mother and father and three kids, but the youngest kid was only like 1 or 2 years old. His name was Trevor. And they had a nanny on board the Titanic with them to help take care of Trevor. Well, the nanny took Trevor into a lifeboat, and the parents didn't realize it. And as a result, the parents and their older daughter, I guess there's just one other child on board now that I'm thinking about it. And this was still a young girl. I mean, you know, a kid still, but not as young as her brother. And this Lorraine and her parents ended up going down with the ship because they didn't know that the younger brother had left. And so they refused to leave the ship. You know, they were holding out hope that she's lost somewhere, but they'll find her before the ship goes down. And of course, that never happened. So there are just tons and tons of stories like that. More first class men survived than third class children. So there's this terrible inequity that occurred. I mean, it's horrendous in that regard. And it's poignant because I think that, you know, the whole idea of the way that Jack and Rose's story was told really does come through. You can find some of that in almost everybody who was on board the Titanic or who was a family member of someone who was.
Right. Like you said, a lot of families that you know, it, like you said, there's a main love story, and then there's some backstories, you know, especially how Jack got on the boat to begin with, you know, winning the tickets in a poker game and, you know, stuff like that, and, you know, them falling in love. We don't even know what the span of time could have been, but she ends up getting out of the boat because she doesn't want to leave him. She wants to make sure he survives, and, you know, they did everything up until the end to, you know, stay alive with each other. He gave her the plank of wood. He stays in the water and ends up freezing to death. At the end, she, you know, grabs the whistle from one of the men that had one, so the last boat that actually came back to see if there's any survivors can get her, and it all ends, you know, not a whole happy ending, but at least one person from that story survives.
And exactly. And some of that was, you know, even those things, even though those characters were fictional, a lot of those things really did happen. You know, the idea of winning the ticket in a poker game, you know, the whole process for making reservations and boarding ships was, of course, nothing like it is today. You know, today you'd never be able to get away with that. But back then, of course, you didn't have, you know, computer systems. You didn't have the need for all the extensive, you know, photo IDs and security clearances and everything. And so people were traveling in some very weird situations on occasion. And the idea of the being in the boat and then getting out of the boat is probably a call out. I mean, I can't speak for James Cameron personally, but I've got to believe that was a call out to Isidore and Ida Strauss, who were the co-owners of what would end up being Macy's department store. And they were a rather elderly couple, and she just absolutely refused to get into a boat without her husband, and he would not go as long as there were any other women or children on board. She actually was in a lifeboat and about to leave the Titanic, and she jumped out of the lifeboat and walked across the deck to rejoin her husband, and of course they never survived.
Yeah. So I watched it audio described, and it was great job by, you know, people who do those audio descriptions, and the boat sounded enormous. You know, I'm surprised it even got off the dock personally, as big as it was described, with all the master staircases and the levels of the boat, and, you know, the guys having to shovel coal into the steam, you know, into the you know, where the what makes the boat go. I mean, all that, it's again, it's an amazing story. I'm going to finish reading your book, and I'm actually going to read the actual book too, to see, you know, do some comparison. And why don't you tell everybody where they can find your book at? I mean, it's free, and, you know, as long as you're an Apple user, you can find it, but I'll let you do the honors on that one.
Yeah, so it's actually already available, that is correct, on the Apple Books store. And I guess we can actually put a link in the description in the video if they play it back afterwards, and in the podcast description, can't we? We can put a link to it.
Oh yeah, I can definitely do that.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and do that. But it's called Titanic: The Most Complete Story Ever Told. It's listed as Anniversary Edition, and it is, as I say, available on all your Apple devices right now. For those who do want a different format, we will have a soft cover and a narrated audiobook available this spring. So those are in production now, and we're looking forward to their imminent release. But in the meantime, you can get the full book, and it is interactive. There are some really cool things that only the Apple version will allow us to do. Some photo galleries, a little
Don't you even have some clips. Music clips in there? Yeah, I was about to say. Yeah. So touch on a little more about what actually has been found over the years, I'm assuming on the ocean floor, of this great ship that crashed that supposedly couldn't be sunk.
Yeah, there's been a lot of things that have been recovered. Hundreds and hundreds of artifacts have been recovered now. Of course, the ship itself was found. And no one has, I don't think, ever seriously considered raising the Titanic. You know, it's certainly been talked about, but a lot of people, especially the folks who found it, Ballard's Group and then RMS Titanic Incorporated, who, you know, got the salvage rights to it, they all feel that it would kind of be akin to disturbing a gravesite. You know, so they really had no desire to raise the Titanic. But we have tons and tons of artifacts that have been brought up. Anything from, you know, dinner plates, you know, ceramic dolls, perfume bottles, you know, things that were preserved through time that wouldn't be destroyed by the water and the underwater microbes and everything that would eat away at this stuff. And any of the museums that you go to, the most well-known, or I should say the largest museum in the world, that is the Titanic Museum, is actually in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. I'm not really sure of the story of how it ended up there, but it is it's an incredible experience. And there are tons of artifacts. We actually had a really unique opportunity when we were there. There was they actually had on temporary display the violin that was played by the bandmaster of the Titanic. The Titanic's band, as it's been called, really wasn't so much a band as a small ensemble, but whatever. Anyhow, two of them, but they were all directed by conducted by a guy named Wallace Hartley. And there were eight people in total. All of these guys, I mean, they were just kids. They were all in, I don't think any of them was over, I don't think any of them was even 30. I think they were all in their 20s, if I remember. And of course, all eight of them sacrificed their lives to play music, you know, to keep the passengers calm, and ended up not surviving. But the bandmaster's violin was recovered later. And we actually had an opportunity to see that at the museum. I mean, you couldn't touch it or anything, but it was displayed. And then it was going to go to Europe and be auctioned off shortly after. So that was a rare thing that we got to see. But there are tons and tons of things that, you know, have been brought up over the years.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of controversy. I mean, was the boat going, was he going too fast? Did the guy on the radio that was getting messages out to, you know, loved ones back home, did he ignore the wrong message? I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff that could be said that shoulda, coulda, woulda. So, what is your, you know, I mean, everybody has an opinion, but what do you think happened ultimately at the end of the day?
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it's a very, very complex question to answer, because first of all, of course, you never want to speak ill of people who worked so hard to give their lives, or who, no matter what, who passed away, who lost their lives. You know, nobody enjoys doing that. And, you know, it was certainly a combination of factors. You know, in all actuality, the captain is responsible for his ship, his or her ship. I mean, that's a rule of both the sea and air travel to this day. So in a lot of people's minds, it really doesn't go any farther than that. But I do think they were definitely traveling way too fast for the waters that they were in. A lot of people have tried to blame the lookouts, or blame Bruce Ismay, the chairman of the line. I don't agree with those findings. I think that the lookouts did the best they could under the conditions they had. And I think Bruce Ismay ultimately was just a passenger. And no matter what he said or did, ultimately it was not his ship to command. And I know that he knew that. I mean, he may have been anxious about beating the record of the sister ship, whatever. But ultimately, at the end of the day, he was a smart man. He wasn't an idiot, and he knows that he's not in charge of this ship. What I do think, and this is very unpopular to say, because again, these wireless operators, they worked so hard, and they really almost gave their, one did give his life. The senior wireless operator did lose his life. The junior wireless operator did survive. But I do feel they bear some responsibility. Part of the problem was back then wireless radio communication was a secondary thing. You know, these guys really were not employees of White Star Line. And so technically, their first responsibility was to make the passengers happy, you know, over and above the officers. And so you'd get a little feel for that. But you would think that if something as serious as an iceberg warning comes in, that they would immediately make that a priority to run that up to the bridge. And they did not do that in multiple cases. The second officer in that recording that I described to you that he made in the 1930s, that audio record, I mean, he point blank said, had he gotten this one iceberg warning in question, that he would have, no questions asked, he would have slowed the ship down, and that he then would have gotten the captain, and the captain would have probably stopped the ship for the night. But again, you know, hindsight is 20/20. It's easy to say that 20-some years later that you would have done that. Reality is nobody thought the ship could sink, so it probably wasn't a priority. They should have known, because the sea was completely calm, so you're not going to have the breaking of waves around the foot of the iceberg like you would if you had a rougher sea. There was no wind. There was no moon. And so it was extremely difficult to see anything in the water. It was a black night. And that iceberg was a rare kind of iceberg that, due to the melting and refreezing that had occurred, it had kind of turned turtle in the water such that it was like a blue, really a clear color, but made blue by the ocean. But at night, it would have appeared completely black. So, I mean, everything was against them in those regards. And, you know, you'd have thought that that combination of factors would have made somebody be the voice of reason and say, we ought to slow down. But again, I guess when you believe that your ship is unsinkable, you don't think in those terms. I don't know.
Well, I mean, the sea's not going to be completely empty. And like you said, everybody knew there was icebergs in the water. Now, right. I don't understand it, but maybe you do. Exactly how fast, like miles per hour, was the ship going? I mean, they said 21 knots, 23 knots, but unless you're a captain, you don't know what that means.
Yeah, that I don't remember the exact conversion. We'll have to ask Siri, but I would say I do know just from the things that I've, you know, heard and worked with and studied that, you know, they were going roughly somewhere probably between 25 and 28 miles per hour in the water that night, which, you know, again, a ship of that size, you're talking about a ship that was 882 feet long. And so the rate of turn on those things and the stop time would have been just incredible. You know, you couldn't, and the way you had to stop a steamship too, it's not like just, you know, slamming on the brakes. And so consequently, they probably should have been, if anything, you know, if they were trying to chance it at all at that time of night, probably nothing more than 5 or 10 knots would have been advisable.
Yeah. Well, like I said at the beginning, I think it was probably something that was not unavoidable based on the fact that somebody said, not even God can sink this ship. That's just something you don't do. I mean, you read through the Bible, and I'm not trying to turn this into a debate of whether you believe or not. But the bottom line is, I know who I believe in. And if somebody says that, I think I'm getting off that ship if I hear them say it. Because where my faith is, I know, you know, God's not going to destroy the earth like he did with the flood and all that stuff again. But, you know, a tragedy that big has to raise some eyebrows and make people step back and think. You know, we thought this shit was unsinkable. We thought we had everything, you know, figured out. We thought we could, you know, whatever. The guy didn't bring the iceberg message. I mean, all that has to line up with something.
Yeah, there was so much of it that just if any one thing had been slightly different, might have spared the ship. But, you know, then again, with the number of icebergs in the water that night, it's amazing, you know, that they didn't have other problems before that. But there are, you know, while we're talking on those lines, you know, because you and I have both made no secret of the fact that we are born again, we are believers in Christ, and, you know, our lives are based on his word. There are some incredible stories of God's favor. You'll read a couple later on in the book. One is of the chief baker on the Titanic, who was taking the time to bring up loaves of bread to load into the lifeboats, because his thinking was, if you need lifeboats, you're probably going to need provisions, you know, and supplies. And so he kept going down to the galley and carrying up loaves of bread. And he had the people who worked under him do the same thing. And then he helped out in other ways around the ship. And by the time he was finally, you know, felt that he was, had done everything he could, all the boats were gone, and he had, you know, he was witnessing the last few minutes of the ship. He slid down the side of the ship and actually survived in the water for probably two and a half to three hours, maybe a little more, without ever getting his head wet. And we're talking about 28 degree water that nobody would think you could survive. You know, now he attributed it, or some of the historians attributed it to the fact that he had some whiskey in his cabin before he got into the water. But we all know who the source really is, and you know, who really spared his life that night. And the other story that I think is even more awesome is of the second officer Lightoller, who, again, he waited till the last possible moment and had no intention of leaving the ship. And the ship finally went down, and he was in the water, and he he got into a situation where the steam and the water that was pouring down the ventilator of the ship had created a suction that pressed him up against the side of the Titanic. And I mean, he thought he was a goner at that point, because of course that he was basically pinned to the side of the Titanic as it was plunging down into the water. And he said that he spoke the words of Psalm 91:11 specifically, you know, for he will command his angels concerning you. He'll give his angels charge over you to guard you in all your ways. They'll lift you up that you might not strike your foot against the stone. And I mean, it was like, as I say it in the book, it was like it had been rehearsed from the foundations of the world. This wave basically pushed up and washed him free of the ship, and he was able to survive. He was able to get to an overturned boat, and of course, you know, he lived to tell about it. So there are some amazing stories of God's favor too in this whole thing.
Yeah, them are all amazing stories, and you know, I'm glad that they implemented the Christian or the faith into the story, because people wouldn't have survived without it. Because I mean, you can't say no. I mean, they already said the ship was unsinkable, and well, we know that wasn't happening. But for them to say, okay, we can survive on our own, everybody knows that's not possible. So
that's right.
I say all the time, one, you know, another day breathing, another gift given to me by God. So
absolutely.
I mean, that's just how it goes. So I mean, any closing thoughts on the, you know, because I mean, I'm not, I mean, we're, I don't want to, you know, give everything away from what you're doing, you know, at the 9-year anniversary of the book that you wrote?
Yeah, technically it's 10, because I started writing it 10 years ago. It was released in 2012, but it's, yeah, technically 10 years.
Yeah, so we're doing that in April, on April 10th, I think you said. So any closing comments and thoughts? I mean, of course, we know everybody. Well, if you don't know, you can visit Matt's blog at ttjtech.net. It's all about technology and, you know, resources and things to get you up and running. Of course, I have stirredup.com, where you can listen to the podcast, and, you know, we do a lot of stuff there. So just go check out our websites. But, you know, anything else on the book that you want to tell them about?
I think that about covers it for now. I think it's, as I say, it's a powerful story. There's a lot that can be gained from it, and or learned from it maybe. And you know, we hope you'll check out the Apple Books version and the other versions as they become available. And hope you'll join us in April. Any thoughts you want to share and questions you want to ask, that'll be the time to do it.
All right, well, we thank Matt from TTJ.net for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Take care.